Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Paul Lerner, and I'm coming from the University of Southern California, and I'm delighted to introduce today's guest, Professor Robin Judd. Professor Judd, who earned her PhD in German and Jewish History at the University of Michigan, is Associate Professor of History at The Ohio State University, where she specializes in Jewish, transnational, and gender history, with particular interests in Holocaust studies, the history of anti-Semitism, the history of religion, the history of leadership, and the history of migration. Extremely active in academic and community service, Professor Judd is a recent past president of the Association for Jewish Studies. Among her many publications are the book Contested Rituals, Circumcision, Kosher Butchering, and Jewish Political Life in Germany, 1843 to 1933, which appeared with Cornell University Press in 2009. The book emphasizes the agency of the rabbis, community officials, and ordinary German Jews who grappled with political opportunities and setbacks, advancing the field beyond previously dominant narratives of assimilation and anti-Semitic persecution to show how German Jews navigated these entangled identities and imperatives, adapting to modernity and responding to changing political and cultural constellations. Her new book, which is the subject of today's discussion, is Between Two Worlds, Jewish War Brides After the Holocaust. It was published last year by the University of North Carolina Press and just received 2 National Jewish Book Awards. So I'm very happy to have Professor Robin Judd here with us today. Welcome, Robin.
Thanks so much, Paul. It's so great to be here.
It's really nice to talk to you, and I'm very excited about the book. And I think before we dive into the book, I just want to give you a chance to introduce yourself to our listeners, to tell us a little bit about your path to becoming a historian and how your particular set of interests came together. So tell us a little bit about yourself, please.
I am a historian who has always been interested in storytelling. But I did not necessarily think of myself as a historian when I was an undergraduate. Even though I was a double major in history and political science, I really wanted to be the next Bella Abzug. I wanted to run for Senate from the state of New York, and I had long sort of imagined myself in that capacity, that I would use history as storytelling as a way to kind of catapult myself into political office. And I worked in DC for a number of years and realized during those years that I loved the questions that drove me around identity politics and community formation and how communities respond in crises, but I didn't want to engage with those questions as a politician. I wanted to engage with those questions as a historian. And so that's what sort of led me on the path, first at the University of Michigan, where I did my MA and my PhD. And then that took me here to Columbus, Ohio, and The Ohio State University.
Great. Thank you so much. And I can see one of the questions I wanted to get into was storytelling, because this book does many things, but one of the things it does is collect a lot of stories, which are often quite moving and epic in scope. So I see how that continues to animate your work. I think the next question I wanted to ask you, people who've had the chance to read the book already will know the answer, I think, at least in part. But for those who haven't, maybe you could tell us a little bit about how you got into this particular topic and where the idea for the book came from.
So the idea really had 2 origin points. One is a 3-story walk up in Yonkers, New York, where my grandparents lived along with my great uncles and aunts. So there were 3 sets of family on 3 different stories. And at the very top story was my grandparents' home. And there were photographs of my grandfather as an American GI in his military uniform. He fought with the Blue Devils in Italy. And there was a photo of my grandmother's gymnasium class in Czechoslovakia, where she was the only woman. And I knew at a really young age that my grandmother had been a Jewish war bride, but the way she told her story and the ways in which I had learned narratives around the Holocaust, I thought her experience was really exceptional. So that would mean that the second origin point is in the classroom. When I began teaching history of the Holocaust, I really wanted to teach it differently than the ways in which I had learned it, which meant using more memoirs in the history classroom, including memoirs written by women. And as I began to gather some of the early memoirs written by female survivors, I noticed a trend, namely that several of them ended with mentioning the men that they met either at liberation or immediately after liberation and married them. So that then led me to begin to ask the question about my grandmother, how unique was she, and about these women more generally. To what degree was there a subset of Jewish war brides who had been Holocaust survivors among the much larger category of war brides more generally?
That's a perfect segue for the next question I wanted to ask you, which is if you could define a war bride and tell us in what ways are the Jewish war brides who are the subject of your book different from the kind of broader population of war brides?
So as you know, Paul, I mean, one of the things that we always struggle with is the usage of various terms. And the term war bride is not a perfect one for many reasons. But in essence, war brides refer to the civilians living abroad who marry military personnel who are serving in those locations. And the term war bride itself is a term that's used by the American and Canadian forces with tremendous regularity during the Second World War. It's used less by the British, which is why using the term war bride is imperfect. Also, you could be a male war bride. So the term war bride suggests that all war brides were women, but they were not. One could be a male war bride, and indeed, Cary Grant has a well-known movie, I Was a Male War Bride, which doesn't have anything to do with Jews, but has everything to do with the war bride phenomenon. The U.S., Britain, and Canada, which are the three countries that I study, were not unique in that they had military regulations that dictated when and how a member of the military personnel could marry a foreign civilian. They also had regulations surrounding the immigration of those individuals. And so those are the policy questions that in many ways shape the larger project that I embarked on. The women that I study were unique. I should really say the women and men that I study, because there were some Jewish male war brides, again, exceptional, but there were some. They shared several commonalities with other war brides. They were governed by some of the similar policies. They also had to make decisions about how they would travel to the United States, Britain, Canada. Would they take advantage of the war bride ships or trains or planes that were sponsored by those countries, or would they choose to travel privately? There were a number of ways in which they shared other commonalities. They were moving into their spouses' homes after the war, often to a culture that was unfamiliar to them. The survivors that I study were unique in that first, they become wrapped up in questions around fraternization that were sometimes similar and sometimes different from other war brides. So for example, the US, Britain, and Canada all had policies regarding which members of the military personnel could interact with civilians in occupied Germany after the war. And they shift and revise that fraternization policy over the course of 1945, so that we'll actually see the military forces having different policies around whether or not the former victims of the Nazi Reich can marry. And some of that will depend on where they're born. So that might mean that a woman living in Germany who wants to marry a member of the American military personnel can do so if she's Jewish and in the American zone, can't do so if she's Jewish and in the Canadian zone, definitely cannot do so if she's non-Jewish, German-born, and in either of the zones. So it becomes sort of complicated when and where they are the same. the Jewish women are dealing with this, and men are dealing with the specific traumas of the Holocaust. And that's a lot of what I write about, is how that trauma shaped them, shaped their encounters, shaped their marriages. The encounter sites are a little bit different. One of the things that I'm really interested in is often the ways in which where they met or how they remembered where they met become part of Jewish stories, kind of returning Jews to a place that, to use Alon Confino's language, right, wanted to be a world without Jews. I'm interested in some of their linguistic challenges, the unique sort of obstacles and challenges that Sephardic Ladino speakers might have experienced, even when they marry into sort of Jewish families that you might think might have cultural similarities. So there were multiple ways in which they were similar and different from the other war brides around them.
Since you mentioned the Ladino speakers and Sephardic experiences, that leads me to remark on one of the things that really strikes the reader in this book that you notice right from the beginning of the first chapter is you're dealing with a much more kind of expansive notion of Europe than I think many, or I should say of those affected by the Holocaust than many historians before you have, that your account takes us into Southeastern Europe, into North Africa. It kind of embraces a much broader view of Jewish experience than we often get in stories about the Holocaust. So I think that must have, that's one of the things that makes the book so exciting and so innovative, but I think it also must have made your job a lot more difficult. And I wondered if you could talk about where you found the material, how you chose the particular cases that you delve into fairly deeply in the book, because you, I should mention for people who haven't had the chance to read the book yet, there are several recurring characters and kind of major stories that are interspersed with other briefer accounts, and then a kind of very detailed and differentiated picture of, as you were saying before, Robin, the kind of legal framework and the kind of the different regulations and ordinances which made immigration and marriage possible in some situations and not in other situations. And I kept, as I was reading it, I kept thinking, how do you keep track of all of this? It's really quite an enormous set of things to keep in your head at one time.
This was a great second project. And by that, I mean, I think, I don't know that I could have done it justice for the first book, both because the amount of time that it required, but also just the sort of depth of knowledge, just the, you know, the sheer quantity of things that we read over time. Each time we teach, we bring in new books, we read the new scholarship. And I think that I was able to sort of rest on the shoulders of the giants that came before me for this book, and be influenced by some of the really amazing work that's been done in the last decade and a half in the history of the Holocaust, that have pushed us to rethink questions of periodization, right? That have pushed us to think about questions of geography, that have kind of allowed us to think more around understanding liberation and the sort of the longue durée of recovery and reconstruction. So while I began the project thinking that I would stay in Germany, because I was a Germanist after all, right? And thought that it would be sufficient to think about the survivors who marry military personnel, meet and marry military personnel in Germany. It quickly became obvious to me that that would offer a really distorted narrative of the Jewish war brides. That if I wanted to do this work, that I had to travel to several different countries, work in several different languages, pull together a lot of different data. And I ended up in many ways writing two books or multiple books. I needed to write out several stories first, right? There were aspects of this project that had to get written out that I knew wouldn't be the narrative that would work for the book. It would be fascinating to me, but boring to almost anybody else, right? Or maybe fascinating to my parents and boring to everybody else. But I did have to write that arc. Like, I had to figure out what was unique about the Dutch war brides, what was unique about the German war brides, what was unique about the Tunisian and the Algerian, right? I had to kind of write it out in sections and then take a step back and ask myself, okay, what is the big question driving the book? And the big question driving the book, how do these individuals make sense of their world after trauma within these relationships? Like, how does this particular kind of relationship give them a space with which they make sense of the trauma in which they've been experienced? And really, to do that justice, I needed to pull out a few characters who could illuminate the similarities and differences. So, for example, in that first chapter on liberation, I chose two women whose stories are remarkably distinct. Floria Goda, who grows up in Zagreb and experiences the war in an island in the sea, and then in Bari, Italy. So she goes from Split to Krusla to Bari. She meets her husband just around the time that Sala Gornchek is experiencing her nth number of deportations, right? So Sala and Floria are about the same age, and yet their wartime experiences are so different. Their liberation experiences are so different. One is a Ladino speaker, one speaks Yiddish. And so I wanted to kind of choose people whose stories could illuminate similarities and differences. And that meant choosing individuals who had multiple forms of sources that I could weave together. My source base was really wide. It included testimonies that had already been done, interviews at the Shoah Foundation or at the Holocaust Museum, interviews that I did, memoirs, letters, diaries, chaplaincy reports, commander reports, notes and letters from other military personnel who are writing about these marriages, military papers, Americanization reports, warship newsletters. The war bride ships had newsletters that they produced, materials from war bride clubs. I mean, it was sort of a wide array of materials. And in some cases, I just had little snapshots of the individuals. And in other cases, I was able to bring things together. And it was that helped me choose which of the individuals I would use as characters throughout the book and which of the individuals I might reference in the notes or kind of keep in mind as I was doing my writing.
It's really interesting to hear a bit about your process because as I read the book, the stories are so intact and so fulsome, right? And so rich. Even though I'm a historian, I wasn't always thinking, and I think that's just a testament to your how elegantly and kind of fluidly you present everything. I wasn't thinking, how does she know that? Where did she find that? And why these cases? I mean, I assumed these cases were chosen to illustrate the range of experiences and also that you had good material on them, but I wasn't picturing you working diligently behind the scenes to kind of connect pieces and kind of pull archival finds together with testimonies and memoirs and so forth. So I think that's really, it's such a polished and elegant book. We don't really think about you working so hard behind the scenes, but it's clear upon reflection that this was an enormous amount of work. And I know you were working on it for quite a while and you had to travel quite a bit and go to different archives and, as you said, work in different languages. So I think that's I was going to ask you before about how you chose the stories that you chose, but I think you already partially answered the question that you were able to kind of find, you were able to piece them together in ways that other stories, which might have also been interesting, just didn't, there weren't the same sources available for.
I think that's absolutely true. And I mean, and there were stories that I could have included that I didn't, right? I mean, so one, I'm just thinking, you know, off the top of my head, there's a couple that I reference really briefly in the book, but there was an earlier version of the outline where they would have had a more significant position. And I just decided as I was doing the revising that I didn't, that they sort of made it heavier and I needed to take them out. So I think trying to keep an eye towards writing a book that was going to please my colleagues in history, but also be the kind of book that somebody who might just, it might just pull it off the shelf, doesn't necessarily like to read nonfiction, but would find themselves sort of swept up in the narrative. Like I wanted to hit both of those sweet spots in terms of the writing.
Well, you definitely succeeded at that. And I think, you know, you, as you said a minute ago, and I wanted to come back to this, you're making interventions in discussions of trauma and memory and gender, but you're not doing it with a heavy hand. You're kind of, it's not a kind of heavily analytical academic article, rather one that kind of guides you into these points through the life experiences and the stories. But I did wonder if we could come back to that a little bit and talk about the, as you said, your kind of intervening in discussions of periodization, chronology, continuities, and trauma, and how those things play themselves out in these kind of relationship stories. So, in some ways, it seems to me that a marriage, a relationship is a sort of a place of consolation, of kind of healing with happy endings. But you show in the book that it's a lot more complicated than that, right? And that the differences in experiences between husbands and wives often mattered and made life continually difficult for many of these people. So it's not just the sort of, they met, they fell in love, they got married, they came to the U.S. and lived happily ever after, right? Your stories are a bit more complex.
Yeah, as I often say when I speak about the book, for anyone who's been married, right, you know that marriage is not simple. It's not, you know, it's a lot of work. And can be quite messy. I was just so fascinated when I realized that my grandmother's story wasn't unique, and that there was this group of individuals who had married military personnel. I was just so fascinated by them because, of course, we know much about the trend among DPs to marry one another, and these women and men that I study were not part of that world. And in fact, part of the reason why the book is called Between Two Worlds is that these individuals move from often the DP camps or other returnees, survivor constellations, move from that into a war bride space. And they're liminal. They don't really fit in either one. They're exceptional in both of those locations. Some of the couples that I met were quite explicit about wanting to marry individuals who had not experienced the lager, who had not been in the camps. And indeed, one of the women, in several of her testimonies, said something like, "I wanted to marry a cheery American." Now, of course, she marries a Canadian, and it says something about what she knew then, that even later in her testimony, she thinks of him as a cheery American, even though he was from Montreal. So we have that. We have refugee soldiers who are very thoughtful about naming a phenomenon of their fiancés, these women that they're meeting, as being their new female family members. One refugee soldier writes to his fiancé, "You are my sister, you are my mother." Both of his sister and mother had been murdered in the camps. So there's so much sort of strategy, if you will, that's at play. One of the couples that I study, Lala and Morris Fishman, she related that when she went to the DP camp that Morris ran and asked a question about immigration, he said, you should just find yourself a soldier and go to the United States like a war bride. And this was a phenomenon. So there was so much sort of strategy and thoughtfulness that went into these courtships. You know, the encounter is the encounter, right? And that's something that I try to write about, that I don't want to romanticize the encounter and making it something that it was not. What becomes in some ways almost romanticized is the ways in which these couples think about and retell their encounter story, so that we move from encounter to courtship. And in those moments, they're thinking about questions of immigration and recovery from trauma and what creating a new relationship with this soon-to-be partner means and looks like.
It's also interesting how they hide parts of their stories. They decide, and I mean, certainly in your family case too, as we find out in the end of the book, but right, they do a lot of curating about what they're going to pass on and what they're going to keep to themselves. So
absolutely. We all do that, right? We cherry pick the stories that we want to retain as ways to narrate our histories. And depending on who we are, how we're wired, et cetera, some of us may cherry pick, you know, fairly optimistic stories. Some of us may cherry pick certain kind of traumatic stories or pessimistic stories. But the reason why I needed to kind of pull together so many different sources was because to build the narrative that I wanted to build, I was trying to integrate or weave together the curation that many of these men and women did alongside and with the materials that I could find in letters, chaplaincy reports, commander reports, medical reports, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And that comes across very, very well. I guess I wanted, having read a lot of your work now, one theme that kind of strikes me that comes through in different contexts is that you, as a historian of, let's say, the modern Jewish experience or experiences, you take Judaism very seriously, right? You write about Jewishness sometimes, but you also write about Judaism in a way that some historians, I think, miss for whatever reason. And I found that in some of the stories you go into, Judaism is really important, and whether it's rituals, observances, devotion, in kind of creating meaning and providing continuity. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the Judaism of some of your subjects in the book.
So absolutely. And I would say this is a case where, having done some rigorous study into Jewish law, Jewish practice over the years, you know, beginning as a graduate student and doing, you know, the Mechinat LaTalmud, that it's really helpful. And it would have been hard to have read some of my sources without that background, right? And it's like that with anything that we do, which is that when we approach our sources, we have to understand the context at play. For many of the individuals I study, Judaism was at the center of their lives, or if it wasn't at the center, it had a deep influence over various aspects of practice. And so I mentioned Sala and Abe Bonder earlier, my Montreal couple. That's a wonderful example of a couple who probably in September of 1945, when they met, would have kind of scoffed at religion as shaping, dictating their lives. Even though they met at Rosh Hashanah services, they might have imagined them as sort of cultural Zionist Jews. And yet, you know, religion plays out in all kinds of ways, from the policy shaping their wedding and how they would marry, who would officiate at the wedding, to the settings in which they meet and spend time, often religious services, the when individuals could marry mattered with Judaism, and that's something that I write about. What happens if a soldier is going to be demobilized, when it's during a period that Jewish law prohibits marriages from taking place. So there were kind of many moments when Judaism mattered a lot. I think for me, the moment that I felt most intensely, if that is even a fair way of describing or appropriate way of describing things, was in the last chapter when I look at the second marriages that many couples had to have. So that there are many couples who marry in some kind of civilian or military marriage in Europe and don't have a religious wedding. And when they come to the United States, Britain, or Canada, either because they themselves wanted it or because it's imposed by their family members, by their usually spouses' family members, they need to have a religious wedding in order for any future children to be considered legitimate. And the kind of narratives around that and questions of agency and power and feeling excluded, that those were those some of the moments that just kind of took my breath away, because you had that sense of these couples who come to the United States, Britain, or Canada. These mostly women, there are some men, mostly women are already stumbling. They don't have the languages. They're cultural outsiders. They're dealing with this huge amount of trauma. Many of them don't have family members, and they're within many of these cases, it's within 3 weeks. In some cases, it's within 48 hours. Have to have this other kind of public wedding, which only exaggerates their sense of feeling like outsiders. And to me, that just it broke my heart reading those sources.
I think that's another really brilliant illustration of the way that something on the surface could seem like just a cause for celebration or a sign of successful adaptation, but with the insights that you're able to bring to bear, it becomes actually quite wrenching.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and he just passed away yesterday, right? The incredible scholar, Lawrence Langer, and thinking about some of his work around the, you know, the disintegrated self, there are all these moments where these individuals are forced to sort of recognize who they wish would be at their side, who is absent. And whether really they had those relationships with those individuals in the way in which they remembered, or if they're, because of the moment, this is the story that they're telling themselves, right? They have at these sort of so-called life cycle events, moments where they see other family and are forced to recognize sort of how alone they feel, and also how alone they imagine those around them see them, right? So, at these second weddings, whether or not all of the guests sort of look at these individuals and say, oh, poor Sala, poor, you know, Lala, poor whomever, Helena, you know, they're all alone with no family, or if they just look and say, oh, what a beautiful bride, the way these women remember these second weddings is everyone thought, you know, I was an orphan. They thought I was an orphan.
Well, I wanted to ask about the kind of where we started a little bit with the what it's like to, because this is a story or a set of stories that for you is clearly very personal and, you know, autobiographical, at least in the sense of your larger family. But it's also a very broad story, which kind of gets at not only one of the fundamental pieces of modern Jewish experience, but also, you know, beyond Jews, this is really a kind of global phenomenon, right? So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what it's like to write about your own family and your own life kind of in this context, and did you feel very self-conscious about that, or did you rather kind of see it as just a something which gave you insight into this much broader phenomenon, and then you could kind of move beyond the individual in that case?
In many ways, it was both. I never thought that I would write the conclusion that I wrote about my own family narrative. I went into the project thinking that I was never going to write about my family, in part because, without giving away too much, people should read the book. There was a secret that we all knew. So I guess it wasn't so much of a secret, but it was shared that it was not to be shared with the public. And so I would write a story about my grandparents, and my grandparents left very little in terms of a historical record. So I was the only one that had access to my grandmother's story. She would only share so much with me. And yet, every time I sort of went somewhere where there might be something about my grandparents' story, I collected materials and would always share it with my father, who was an only child, and my siblings. And at one point when I was writing the book, I began to kind of recognize that this wasn't just giving me insight into my grandparents' story, that my grandparents' story gives insight into the book. And so I drafted an epilogue, which later became the conclusion, and sent it to my parents and my siblings and asked them what they thought. Did they think that I should be including our family history in this book, or should I keep it to the side? And even though we all have our kind of elements of passive aggressiveness, I mean, I was really quite transparent with them that this was their call. And if they didn't want this in the book, then I had another conclusion, which I actually did have. And I shared that with them too, so that they knew that I didn't need it to finish the project. And my siblings both said, you know, it's dad's call. It was his parents. It's his call. And my father, you know, absolutely to his personality, said, I will read it and I will give you, you know, I will tell you what I think in 2 weeks. And indeed, right, 2 weeks to the day, I speak with my parents regularly, but he didn't bring it up. I didn't bring it up because I knew 2 weeks to the day. And indeed, 2 weeks to the day, he called and he said that he wanted me to include it. He thought it was really important. And then he sort of began to take delight in the project. And so there's a picture of him and my grandparents in the conclusion. Recently, the book was reviewed in L'Histoire, and they wanted a color photo. And so there's my father's bar mitzvah photo is there. So I think he's enjoying this sort of new, whatever, 15 minutes of fame. But there was a lot of thinking that went into whether or not I should be sharing my family's history, in part because of the secret, and also because my parents are private individuals, and I didn't want them to feel like I had pushed them into the public arena, or like they didn't have agency over their story. And that's something that I do write about in the book more generally, the importance of the historical actors having agency over their own narrative. And so I always tried in the book, and try, and I'm writing an article now on kind of emotions and encounter, to sort of give credence to the stories that people create and narrate for themselves and how important that is.
I think that's a really good place to end the discussion of the book itself. And I don't want to take too much of your time, but before I let you go, you did mention just now an article that you're working on, and I wanted to, as I generally do at the end of these discussions, just to give you a chance to talk about new projects, new research avenues. I know the book came out pretty recently, so I wouldn't expect you to have gone too far in a new project already, but I'm sure you have other ideas, and I think our listeners would enjoy hearing about them.
So I have two articles that I'm working on that do come out of this book. One looks at the cluster of emotions that get invoked when the couples describe how they met one another. So that initial moment of encounter, I just was fascinated by that question and couldn't really go deeply into it in the book itself. It would have led me down a rabbit hole. And so that book, that article is kind of under revisions right now, and hopefully will be published soon. The other article is sort of only toe deep, and that is that there were a number of infant and childhood illnesses on some of the Warbright ships. I want to know more about those. And there were medical reports, and so I've been collecting materials concerning that. It is possible that I might write an intertwined biography of two of the couples that get featured in the fifth chapter. The fifth chapter looks at sort of the exceptions to the rule, the cases where immigration visas first are extended and then rescinded. So there were two couples where the foreign civilians, the women, both are born and grow up just blocks from one another in Frankfurt, have very different wartime experiences, very different post-war experiences, but are both at the center of these exclusion cases. I've received access to materials here in the United States, all of the surveillance materials. I just received FOIA approval in Britain, so I have to get to London and see what's there. So if there's a lot there, then that might be at the heart of the next project. And if there isn't much there, then that will turn into an article, and then I'll pursue a project that I'm really interested in concerning infertility and miscarriage among female survivors. So there's been a lot on fertility, but I'm actually kind of interested in the ways in which women talk about infertility and challenges having children, particularly during the moment of this baby boom. So that might be an article or a book. We'll see, but that's down the road.
Oh, well, that's something I very much look forward to hearing about. It sounds like a very important avenue of research.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for your time. It was really such a pleasure to talk to you, and I'm so excited about the book and glad to hear that it's getting the recognition that it deserves. And once again, I would encourage everyone to look for Between Two Worlds, Jewish War Brides After the Holocaust, published by University of North Carolina Press. So thank you so much, Robin.
Thank you, Paul. I really appreciate it.